Good morning. I'm calling this meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee to order pursuant to Rule 10.01. I'm Representative Dave Pinto. I'm the chair of the committee. Welcome to members and members of the public. I want to make sure folks realize that our meeting materials are posted to our committee website, so you can find that, members of the public who are watching, and those materials have also been sent to members of the committee as well. And so with that, we're going to start with the taking of the roll, and Ms. Chambers, if you can do that, please.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Dabney. Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Juergens. Representative Cotiza Watoon.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Wozlowick. And Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
We have
and a I know. Thank you, Ms. Chambers. I know Representative Dabney is presenting a bill in another committee, and I think Representative Wozlowick was going to be a couple minutes late as well, but I do expect both of them to join us shortly. And so, members, we have spent the first couple weeks here in several sessions of the committee taking a look at programs that support family well-being, and we learned a lot about brain development and how important it is. Those relationships and in the family context and providing support for families. We're going to be pivoting into having several sessions talking about early care and learning, which is such an important component of our work in terms of child care and early learning. And in a way, today's presentation sort of makes a connection between the two and talks about the economics for families of young kids and connecting with early care and learning, and begins to answer the question that Representative Bennett had asked in our hearing on Tuesday. In terms of essentially, to paraphrase you, Representative Bennett, why is it that that childcare is both such a burden on families, and yet the people who are doing the work we know are receiving very low wages, et cetera. And again, we're going to continue exploring that in the next couple of sessions. But today we have a presentation by Dr. Aaron Sojourner from the University of Minnesota, Carlson School, and really thrilled to have him. He had presented to the committee 2 years ago, for those who were on the committee then as well. And I'm so glad to have him here. And so, Dr. Sojourner, if you can identify yourself when you start, and then please begin with your presentation.
Thanks so much to the committee and Chair Pinto for inviting me to speak with you today. I'm Aaron Sojourner. I'm a labor economist at the University of Minnesota at the Carlson School of Management. I'm going to talk to you today about the first 1,000 days, the first 3 years of life, and how this really lays an important foundation for lifelong success. And, you know, this is a unique time in humans' lives when their brains are forming. It sounds like you've heard a lot of testimony about that already, so I won't get into the pitch there, but you know, the fundamental, as an economist at a management school, you know, the foundation of our community's success is the productivity and capacity of our people, and wise investment in people can drive Minnesota's success. And I think you all recognize that, but that's a theme that echoes throughout. Now, I'm going to show you some evidence and try to make sure that these three points are clear, that, you know, there's a lot of concern about inequities in our society along racial and economic lines and ethnic lines. And, you know, just we want everyone to succeed and develop to their potential and make the contributions to their family and their community that they can. But we see big gaps in the productivity of people in our community and in the achievement scores in K-12. And I want to show you evidence that these gaps really open up early in people's lives, in the first few years of their lives. And they actually stabilize once people get into K-12. It's really these first few years where the inequities of really get baked in, and where we have the opportunity to invest to prevent that from happening. And it is possible. The second thing is, you know, these kind of investments especially can generate high returns. And so it's kind of mysterious. Why don't families make these investments? You know, why is it that families can't afford childcare at the same time, you know, childcare workers aren't paid enough to have a decent living and stay in the profession and attract talent to the sector? And the answer is because we as a community ask the most of families when they have the least private resources. And I'm going to walk you through the logic of that. And if we have time, we'll talk about some new tools that have been developed at the U and with this in partnership with the state to understand families' access to early care and education. So this first bit of evidence here shows you on the horizontal, it shows the relationship between family resources in early childhood in the first 5 years of life on the horizontal. And on the vertical, it shows annual work hours by people in adulthood. And what you see is that, you know, at moderate and high levels of income, if I'm from a moderate or high income family when I'm young, when my first the income in the first 5 years of life and prenatally. Kids who come from very economically disadvantaged families in those first few years end up working a lot less. They have much less success in the labor market. They have a harder time building successful careers and productive careers. And so there's something that suggests this connection between early life experience and adult outcomes.
And Dr. Sergio, I'm just going to stop you for a second. I think you froze up for me, and it's for a couple seconds. I think that you may have for a couple of folks as well. I think we pretty much caught the gist, but we'll just keep an eye on that. But if others had that experience as well, know that you're not alone. So who knows? But yeah, thanks.
I'll try to keep my eye on you if it happens again. You know,
okay.
Flag or something.
Okay, thanks. No problem.
So this graph shows the first 14 years of kids' lives, and it shows age along the horizontal from birth, and it shows how the achievement gap opens up in the first 5 years of life and then kind of stabilizes. So kids whose parents are in the highest earning 20% of families in America are represented in the blue line, and kids whose families have the lowest income, 20% of income in the country, is represented in the orange line. And what you see is that they kind of start off in similar places in terms of cognitive skill tests, but this gap opens up. But then once they hit the K-12 system, you know, the widening of the gap stops. It maybe closes a little bit through the K-12 system, but at least it stops growing. And another way to see this is to look at the structure of people's brains, do brain scans. It sounds like you've heard some of this before, but I'll just say, I don't know if you've seen this one exactly. From age 5 months to basically age three, 36 months, they took brain scans on kids from different kind of families of different income and advantage levels, high socioeconomic status in green, low socioeconomic status families in blue. In the first year of life, you know, the structure of their brains looks quite similar, but this gap opens up in the next 2 years, and you see these inequalities opening up. Now, there's a lot of possible explanations for this. It could be, you know, there's an old nature versus nurture debate. You know, you can think of a lot of, they do have different care experiences, but they also live in different parts of the community. They have different families and social supports around them. So, you know, this is all just association. But what I want to show you is some evidence that better early care experiences can really break these relationships. These are not inevitable patterns. These are patterns that show up in our current policy environment, in our current economic environment, and they're a choice that we allow to continue. So this is one results from one study that I worked on, that I did. There are many other studies like this. It's just one I know well. So they recruited families as they were giving birth to kids in hospitals in 8 cities around the country. And this happened in the mid-80s. And they randomly assigned some low-income families to get access to free full-day high-quality childcare for 2 years, between 12 months and 36 months. So starting at age 1, going to age 3. And they also had weekly home visits in the first year of life. So there was take a group of newborns from families without a lot of income, and then flip coins. Some of them come up heads, some of them come up tails. Nothing systematically different about these two groups except heads versus tails. Same genetics, same family, same types of families, same types of communities, same types of kids, same types of prenatal experiences even. But one of them comes up heads, they get access to this free full day childcare and weekly home visiting. The other comes up tails and they don't. And there's hundreds of in each group. After a year, they measure the kids' mental development. And there's a small gap after that year, 0.16 standard deviations. The treatment group is doing a little better. Once they have access to the child care centers, though, the child development centers, at age 2, 12 months later, and at age 3, you know, after 2 years of access, the treatment group kids from these low-income families, their IQs are 1.3, 1.6 standard deviations higher than the control group families from low-income families. So, I mean, that is an enormous difference. Those kids are the kids in the treatment group from low-income families are scoring on these cognitive tests higher or about the same as the high-income kids in the control group. So there's no difference between like kids from low-income families and kids from higher-income families if they had access to this treatment, to this high-quality care experience and home visiting. And, you know, at that point, the treatment ended at 36 months. So on the kid's 3rd birthday, the experiment shut down. They didn't have any access to anything systematically different. And then 2 years later at kindergarten entry, they went and gave these cognitive tests again to everybody in the treatment and control group. And, you know, they did it again at age 8, 3rd grade, and age 18, 15 years after the thing ended. At kindergarten entry, there was definitely a fade down of this effect, but it was not a fade out. It was still a very big effect, 0.6 standard deviations. That's like 10 IQ points. And that is, again, they look more like high-income control group kids than low-income control group kids. So they look, if they had access to this care, they're doing, you know, it's closing the gap, substantially closing the gap. 5 years later, 15 years later, you know, these are still very substantial gap benefits and persistent benefits. And even 15 years later, they still look more like kids in the higher income control group than kids in the low income control group. So this is pretty, I mean, this to me is very strong evidence that these early care experiences can make huge differences in kids' development, can close these income-based gaps that we see in the world. And, you know, that our failure to make those investments is part of what's leading to the outcomes we see. Now, they also did this for higher income kids from higher income families. And they, again, there were hundreds of them. They flipped coins. Heads, you get access to the treatment. Tails, you don't. So you can see the effect of the same kind of treatment on kids from higher income families. And what you saw is that the effects were smaller and they faded out. So, there are still big effects in the first couple of years there, but then they stop being significant in the follow-ups. And this is consistent with a lot of evidence in this area, that the effects of these investments are bigger for kids from more disadvantaged families because they have sort of worse worse experiences in the absence of these investments. So you all are familiar with Grunewald and Rolnick's work, I'm sure, calculating the rate of return to Perry preschool. And it's been replicated by James Heckman, a Nobel laureate economist at the University of Chicago. Rolnick and Grunewald said there was a 16% rate of return if you look at the cost of the investment up front, and then you wait and you see the flow of benefits that are created over time in terms of savings on special education and discipline, grade retention and averted crime and extra earnings and less use of social public benefits. Heckman reproduced this, pushed harder. He got estimates like 8%, 12% rate of return. Now consider this, these are investments that the public could make in care experiences for children from the most disadvantaged families. They generate these high rates of return, 8%, 12%. Alternatively, we can use private capital is deployed in the private economy. And like one way to measure its return is to look at the stock market returns. Real rate of return in the stock market is about 6% since World War II. So, capital deployed in the private economy is generating about a 6% rate of return. Capital deployed into investing in high quality care experiences for young children from disadvantaged families, it's 8% and above. Now, 8% versus 6%, that doesn't sound like a very big difference, but I want to tell you that with the way that rate of return works, the way that exponential growth works, 8% is much more than double 6%. It sounds weird, but it's true over a long horizon. So if you invest a dollar, and there's no interest, you're on the blue line, 50 years later, you still have a dollar. If you invest at 6% over 50 years, at the end of that time, you have a little bit less than $20. But if you invest at 8% after 50 years, you have $50. So 8% rate of return is a lot better when you're thinking about a lifetime of benefits flowing from it than 6% rate of return. The second thing is, we ask the most of families when they have the least. And this is a report that I worked on when I worked at the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Basically, the point is that families have the least private resources when their children are young. They have the least private resources early in their kids' lives. And they also have the most private responsibility when their kids are young, early in their kids' lives. And that combination means that they're absolutely caught in an economic vice between the burden and the responsibility of care and the responsibility of earning. And balancing those dual responsibilities is very hard. We make it much easier for them once their kids turn 5. But in those first 5 years of life, it's really a crushing dilemma that they're in. So, what do I mean they have the least private resources? When your kids are young, as a parent, you are young. So you've had less time to work and save. You have less past income. We also computed like the average wage of parents based on how old their youngest child was. So when your youngest child is 0 to 2, your hourly wage is like 8% lower than it average as a parent. When your kids are in high school, your wage is 10% above average. So when your kids are young, your current earning power is lowest. You have the least past income. You have the least current earning power. We also documented, so when your kids are younger, you do have more future income. In theory, you have more access to future income. But in fact, you don't, because your credit scores are worse when your kids are younger than when your kids are older. And we documented that for the first time. So look, that's all the private income, guys. When kids are young, parents have less past income, less current income, and less access to future income than they will when their kids are older. So they don't have private resources in those first 5 years. Later on, when their kids are in elementary and high school, they will have more resources. But in early childhood, they do not. That's the private side. On the public side, we don't undo that or compensate for that. We actually make it worse. We make it harder. So we invest more when kids are older. If you look at the age of the child on the vertical here, you can see that the orange and the yellow bars are sort of the time that kids spend in publicly financed or publicly subsidized care. And you can see that when kids are young, very little aid and investment goes to finance care. The families are on the hook for the blue, the gray, the green. That's the private responsibility of the families on average across all kids in the United States in 2011. These are based on time diaries of kids. And once they hit 5 or 6 or K-12, you know, the public steps in and invests a lot and takes a big portion of the care burden off of the family's plate, and the economic vice loosens. This is new stuff I didn't share last time. We just calculated this over the summer. And this is for Minnesota specifically. And I did this with Rob Grunewald. And we looked across every kind of care investment that the federal and state government makes that we could get our hands on. So we looked at early learning scholarships, CCAP, Head Start, early Head Start, child dependent care tax credits, VPK, all that kind of stuff. And we looked at the dollars flowing into care subsidies for kids at different ages and kids in different income ranges. And what we see is that for kids in 0 to 2 at the bottom, you know, we're investing about $900 per kid per Minnesota kid per year in the first 3 years of life. And once they're 3 and 4, we're investing about $2,500 a year. Once they get to be age 5, you know, for 13 years, we're investing about $10,000 a year through the K-12 system. And so it goes from 900 a year to 2,500 a year to 10,000 a year. And, you know, it's definitely, we're investing more in kids from low-income families, but even for them in age 0 to 2, we're investing about $2,200 per year per kid. And so I hope this is somewhat informative for you. So we have less, families have the least resources privately when their kids are youngest, and the public puts in the least resources when kids are youngest. And so, you know, it's entirely predictable. There's nothing else that we could expect to happen except for a crisis for childcare, in the childcare sector and, you know, in families' lives, trying to figure out how to balance these dual responsibilities. So, you know, it takes many forms, shortages, not enough slots near me, unaffordable, prices are too high, I have to go too far to try to find something affordable, you know, over demand for investment programs, support programs, businesses can't keep their businesses afloat. They're scraping by to provide care and to generate revenue to cover those costs. They can't pay enough to keep staff. lot of instability and turnover in the workforce, you know, and businesses are struggling to survive. And it's, again, it's no surprise. It's entirely predictable because there's just not enough resources. Families can't generate those resources, and public's not investing those resources in this time of kids' lives and in this stage of families' development. So, yeah, so this is, I think, the root of most of the problems, and it shows up in different ways, but there's just not resources flowing into this time in kids' lives. I know I'm getting short on time.
I was actually gonna suggest a request that you skip this. I mean, if you're gonna do it real quick, but I think I'd like to, if you could address these points.
Wrapping up, I'll just say, you know, early experiences have lifelong consequences and are a scarce investment opportunity. It's not a burden. If I can get 8% rate of return, I want that investment all day long. I want to take as much of that as you'll give me. And we ask the most of family when they have the least. And I'll stop with this. You're welcome to contact me anytime. Happy to try to be of service.
Right. Dr. Sojourner, thank you. I noticed that the second to the last slide, I think this is coming from, if you could just go to the slide before the wrapping up slide, because I do think that is helpful data for us. I know this one, yeah. Can you just maybe say what you've got in this, as long as you have this up?
So Minnesota is definitely experiencing a decline in the number of family providers, and but this is really a national phenomenon. So it's happening everywhere. And if you look around our region, it's happening in other states as well. So the green dotted line is the decline in family care providers in Minnesota from 2012 to 2018. We lost about 30% of the capacity that family providers were producing. But that's the exact same decline. It's actually a little better than Wisconsin. It's a bit worse than North Dakota, but you know, every state in the country is experiencing these declines. And so I think it really has something to do with like the strength of the labor market. So across this whole time, the labor market was getting better and there were better opportunities for family care providers outside of the care sector. There were more subsidies being invested that made other options available to families. This is a trend that Minnesota is seeing for sure, but it's also a trend that's everywhere.
Thanks. Yeah. So members and Dr. Sojourner, thank you so much. Members will open things up to your questions. And I see that Representative Pryor has one, so we'll call on you first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Sojourner. Appreciate, well, I was able to hear this, your talk 2 years ago in committee, but it was good to hear it again. And I could probably hear it like every 6 months and just be reminded of what the data shows us from the lens of economist. Which also coincides with my experience as a parent and a grandparent. So it's nice how these things kind of align and make sense on many different levels. So just a quick question. I remember the slide before about comparing Minnesota and Wisconsin and North Dakota. I don't know if North Dakota was in that time. I remember the Minnesota and Wisconsin comparison. And I guess I'll make the observation that probably now when we look at national averages for home-based childcare providers and how many have been closing, it's going to be so different in that we'll probably have lost track of where reality should be when we look back at 2020. Your slides will have that gap where you say, okay, we're not gonna look at 2020. and even to look at child care centers or and home care, home providers that are opening up. It's going to be a while before that all gets sorted out. But now my question, looking at North Dakota, they did have that leveling off. And is there, you know, theories on kind of what was going on in North Dakota, the oil boom money or anything like that, that can explain the leveling off? But then what I am struck by, there's a leveling off, but then the slope of the line is the same afterwards. So, which, you know, kind of that bigger question, like, you know, is there anything that can be done about this as, you know, in terms of public policy?
And Dr. Sojourner, and if, I don't know if it would be helpful to bring that slide back up for folks to see what the Representative Pryor is referring to in the slope of that line, and then please proceed.
I mean, so this is a slide, this is an image and an analysis that was produced at the Minneapolis Fed. And this article discusses, you know, policy in the states and sort of what led to these different trends. There's a, and I didn't write this, so I don't know all this. I haven't done in-depth analysis of the three different states. I think this rules out some stories, but not others. I think it rules out, you know, kind of state-specific stories about, you know, something specific to Minnesota that's really driving this. And it, you know, something that it has to be something that's common sort of between Wisconsin and Minnesota, and a lot of other states are seeing similar declines. I guess to me, I think family care is really plays an important role in the system, especially in places where there's not enough density to really support centers economically, you know, in less densely populated parts of the community, family care centers make the most sense in a lot of ways. And so it is a challenge. But, you know, the fundamental thing is to see that care, we care about the quality of care more than the form of care. You know, we want kids to have a great experience, and they can have that great experience with their parents. They can have that great experience with in a center. They can have that great experience with a family provider. They can also have awful care experiences in all those settings, or just mediocre. And so what really matters is the quality. And I think Minnesota has done a lot of work to build its parent aware quality rating system. Actually, one of my a PhD student, Jonathan Borowski, who's working in Massachusetts Child Care Research Center now, did research about the impact of parent aware on Minnesota families' choices, and actually sees a real benefit in terms of helping families identify higher quality care. So I think putting more resources into the system and monitoring quality and trying to drive quality up, and you know, creating accountability to ensure that public investments are going to places that are producing great outcomes for kids. You know, that to me is very valuable. But I, you know, I think we see this decline in a lot of places. I don't have a theory of what's different about the slope there.
And I should probably note, my understanding is that this is a similar trend nationally as well. And Dr. Sojourner, I don't know if you have any information to confirm or refute that.
No, that's absolutely right. I don't have a slide on it, but that's also, it's across the board.
Across the country. Okay. And Representative Pryor, follow up from you? Looks like no. Okay. As long as your presentation is up, Dr. Sojourner, I wonder if you could... well, I'll have a few questions, but actually first we'll, I'll call on Representative Wazlawick and we'll do that. So Representative Wazlawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note one that I am here now. I was a little bit late this morning, but just wanted to sort of shed some light on what Representative Pryor had asked about. And one of the things that we talked about in the Family Child Care Task Force was that part of the decline might be explained by, you know, older folks who have been in childcare for a while deciding to retire, or sort of, you know, other reasons why they may stop providing care or close their programs, and that there's just, we're not seeing sort of that uptake with younger folks taking over in some of those places for a variety of reasons, one of them probably being sort of this economic question, right? If folks don't have the, aren't in an economic position to be able to, with childcare, it might be difficult for them to think about starting a family child care or being involved in a child care business. I think that's a piece that we've talked a little bit about is sort of, you know, where the generational differences might be with some of this. And that's part of, I think, part of the reason for the decline, certainly not all of it, but something that we talked about on the task force and sort of continue to puzzle over and discuss on that piece.
Thank you, Representative Wazlawick. And I'll note that for members of the public, that Representative Wazlawick is the co-chair of the Family Child Care Task Force, and Representative Damoth on our committee serves on that task force too. So thank you for that insight. Representative Morrison, and then Representative Juergens, you'll be up next. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Dr. Sojourner, for your presentation. I'm not sure I have a question, more of a statement / exclamation. That slide where you showed how much we invest as a state in early childhood versus each year. Yeah, that one from K through 12 is pretty stark. And on the heels of your statement that, you know, in the first 3 years is when those inequities get baked in. You know, I can't help but think, here we are admiring this problem. We know the answer and we just need the political will to address it. Thanks so much for being here and thanks for your work.
Representative Morrison, thank you. That slide really jumped out at me as well. Dr. Sojourner, you said this was a fairly new one. I had not seen this before in this data, and especially that comparison of $900 on the bottom line versus $2,500 versus $10,000. And that's, of course, the exact opposite of the direction that we know in terms of the payoff. That's in the biggest payoff in the first 12 months and 36 months, and then we invest the opposite direction. So it's which is really powerful. Thank you, Representative Morrison, and good stuff. Representative Juergens, you're up next.
Hand up.
Oh, yeah. Do you? I thought I saw your hand up. Did I? Maybe I didn't. My apologies. Okay. Okay, sorry about that. And so, Dr. Sojourner, could you go shift earlier in your presentation I just wanted to ask about two slides. Very early on, you had the slide showing the link between early childhood poverty and adult poverty. A few more. Yeah, right here. Or adult employment, I guess. And maybe one clarification question is that I would assume that adult employment is linked, that we could assume that it's linked to adult income and adults, and then adult poverty or lack thereof as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, this is just one measure of success and productivity in adulthood. It's a pretty easy to measure thing. It's a pretty unobjectionable, uncontroversial measure. You know, like, I think we can all agree that it's valuable for people to be working and finding productive employment in the community, and the fact that people are struggling to do that, you know, throughout their lives, you know, is a sign that something's not working. And so that's why I chose this. But I, you know, if you want, I can produce, you know, find similar slides, similar graphs. If you look at the poverty rate, if you look at the average income, if you look at, you know, college achievement, educational attainment, if you look at home ownership, if you look at criminal justice outcomes, if you look at public benefit use, if you look at marriage rates, if you look at, you know, a broad range of indicators of what most people would think of as sort of a successful, productive contribution to the community. Something that we hope for everyone, to find a productive place in the community. You know, you see this kind of pattern over and over.
And what I want to ask about then is that when I look at this, I guess I see a cycle in the you know, early childhood poverty for young kids really is about poverty for their parents. I mean, you know, 6 month old is not generally not going to work and getting, right. getting employment, right? So so really, if your income in adulthood is based on the income your parents had when you're a child, well then really the income for your children is very strongly linked to the income of your parents, you know, if you understand what I'm saying. So can you just talk about the cycle? Because I look at this and I see a cycle, I guess, so often, but can you talk about that aspect of things?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that this is, you know, this is a key link by which inequality is reproduced and, you know, passed on from one generation to the next is, and, you know, it locks in diminished opportunity for kids whose parents have had diminished opportunity. And if we want to have a, you know, a society of equal opportunity, a society of where people can reach their full potential, no matter what part of the, you know, if they won the lottery of getting good parent, like depending on who their parents are or what community zip code is, then this is where that, this is the first place and an important like place where those disadvantages get baked in. And it's a key place where we can intervene to break that cycle of poverty.
Thank you. And then if you could flip to the next slide, I just want to ask about this next one. I guess what strikes me here is we focus a lot on the quote unquote achievement gap, various names for it in our K-12 system. And I guess as I view this here, it's really, as your title says, that it's so set by age five. And you had pointed out that actually there is some narrowing in the K-12 system. But can you just talk about, I guess I'm thinking especially about there's presentations from the Erickson Institute, Jeff Nagel, that I've seen, I think you're familiar with as well. We won't be hearing from him in our committee, I don't expect, but can you just talk about kind of what you see or what the research says about trying to close achievement gaps in the K-12 system versus in these first 4 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what drives the big returns to the investments early on in kids' lives is that the level of investment is so low. So it's not just that it's a critical time in people's lives. It's also that the level of investment is so low. And so like the first dollar that you put into some investment opportunity, you know, can be very, you know, there's declining marginal returns. So like the first dollar is more productive than the millionth dollar. And so kids from disadvantaged families, when they're young, again, there's so few private resources available. There's so few public resources available. The returns are very high. It makes a big impact on those kids' lives. In the K-12 system, we're already, you know, at $10,000 per year per kid. We're now, if in fact we were only investing $250 per year per kid or $1,000 per year per kid, the returns might be quite high to raising that. But we're at a place where we're kind of farther out on the frontier of investment, and the next dollar has a higher impact earlier in kids' lives. So I think Minnesota has a lot to be proud of in terms of its K-12 system, and we invest a lot of resources there, and I think they are productive, and I think, you know, that is a key to our state's productivity and success. And there's more opportunity on the table ahead of us, and we can do better, you know, by investing there. And, you know, I'm highlighting early care and education, childcare. That's the research I've done the most of personally and that I know the best. And I think there is a very compelling evidence base for this. But it's also, you know, families with young children struggle on a lot of dimensions. And, you know, nutrition and housing, and you know, they are in this vice of this budget vice. And so things that can support their kids' healthy development, you know, are, can, a lot of them have evidence behind them as being productive.
That's really helpful. And thank you for talking about the, I mean, obviously there's tremendous need for investment in our, as kids are older as well, and recognizing that there's tons to do. And in fact, I think you referenced that there being some narrowing of the gap in those ages. And I think against some real challenges. Yeah, was something more that you want to say about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what you see is that when kids are having high quality educational and care experiences, like they're benefiting from those, and they're learning and they're growing, and they're becoming, they're reaching their potential, and they're becoming, you know, experiencing the foundation here. So I think Minnesota and, you know, America broadly, we invest a lot in these kids from age 5 to 17. And that does equalize opportunity to a large extent. You know, it does create more equality of opportunity for kids. And so they aren't just, there's not just stark inequality based on who your parents are or what your zip code is. And, you know, changing the care experiences and the education experiences of our young kids, that's determining how our community is going to be in the future. That they are our future, and there's also the arguments about facilitating parents' work and, you know, helping employers find labor. Now, I think these are particularly acute during the pandemic. It's like incredibly clear and stark to people that these care and education opportunities also provide valuable service to parents that enables them to, earn. And hopefully one of the silver linings that'll come out of the pandemic experience is like a new appreciation of care work and education work as, you know, critical, not just to developing the next generation, but also enabling parents to earn and balance this sort of dual responsibility they have.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Members, other questions for Dr. Sojourner at all? I'll give just say questions or comments for that matter. This has been really powerful, Dr. Sojourner, and it really sinks in that, as you said, we're asking the most of families when they have the least and when there's really the biggest payoff. And so I really appreciate you you sharing this with us. Members, I'm not seeing other questions or comments. And so with that, Dr. Sojourner, thank you so much again. I really appreciate it.
And, thanks to everyone for having me and for sharing your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. So members, we're going to pivot to, we're going to, in a way, step back a topic, so to speak, to hear from our Minnesota Department of Health about maternal and infant health, and talking about those very earliest days, and have a couple of presenters to discuss this. We'll be having about several programs that have a lot of impact. Maternal infant health, as I say, and then also the WIC program. So I think that Karen Fogg is the first person we have up. And so if you can identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, committee members. I'm Karen Fogg from the Minnesota Department of Health, where I serve as the Maternal and Child Health Section Manager. I've been asked today to talk a little bit about prenatal and infant health here in the state. Next slide. I'm going to skip a few slides that I have presented, but as mentioned earlier, they're available on the website and my contact information is included. So I'm more than happy to answer questions about topics that I don't get to today. So Healthy beginnings, as you know, are healthy foundations for life. Prenatal care, care during pregnancy and the first year of life, establishes a child's growth and development, and also offers the opportunity to improve the overall health of the pregnant person. This also offers a unique time to engage other care team support members, so fathers and other support people in that life of that child and that family. Next slide. So first I'll talk a little bit about prenatal health. Maybe you'll skip two slides. Skip to the next slide, please. So looking at prenatal care utilization here in the state, the national goal for Healthy People 2030 is 80% of pregnant people receive early and adequate prenatal care. What we're looking for is to have everyone in that lightest blue bar on these graphs. This graph shows prenatal care utilization by race and ethnicity. And as you can see towards the right-hand side, non-Hispanic white people here in the state have pretty good rates of prenatal care and already meet that national goal. But there's deep disparity among African-American and American Indian families. COVID-19 has brought the rapid expansion of telehealth services that can fill part of this prenatal care. But then we get into issues with device availability and internet connectivity for some families. Next slide, please. When we asked pregnant women in Minnesota why they were not receiving care, we saw a mixed set of issues ranging from transportation, which is no surprise, to issues with the health system, to not knowing that they were pregnant. Next slide. As you're aware, there's a loss of hospital-based birth services in the state, creating an inequity with our rural populations. This access that we're losing in rural areas contributes to poor outcomes like premature births. We're also seeing that there could be higher rates of obstetric issues because families are not able to get to these services when they need them most. Next slide. So women who use opioids or other substances during their pregnancy are at risk to giving birth to infants who experience neonatal abstinence syndrome. The rates at NAS are highest in the Northwest and the Northeast regions. However, the largest proportion, around 47% of the total cases, are actually in the metro area. Next slide. I'm going to move on to talk a little bit more about infant health and infant mortality. And if you'll just go to the next slide. This is the infant mortality rates for the United States and in Minnesota. So that dark blue bar is the United States. And the green line is Minnesota. Infant mortality is the death of an infant in the first year of life expressed as a rate per 1,000 live births. This is a complex and multifactorial problem caused by a mixture of healthcare related issues, but also socioeconomic issues. Next slide. That overall rate really disguises deep disparity here in the state. This is the same data based on race and ethnicity. That light blue line is American Indian infants, and the green line is infants born to Black or African American mothers. The infant mortality rate for African American babies is 2.3 times that of white babies, and American Indians is 2.5 times that rate. Next slide. Just a brief mention about the urban and rural split, those first two bars. The infant mortality rate is about the same when we look generally, and there's not usually sufficient data to look too far below that, not county by county, because there are too few deaths in so many counties. Next slide. This is the infant mortality rate broken out by maternal education and rate and ethnicity. If you look all the way to the right-hand side is the total for the entire state. Infants born to mothers with less than a high school education, that dark blue bar, are at an increased risk for infant mortality compared to infants born to mothers with higher level education. However, if you look at the grouping all the way to the left, African American and Black mothers with more than a high school education, the lightest blue bar, have the same rate of infant mortality as white mothers. They're over towards the right, with white mothers with less than a high school education. We know that education is related to a variety of social factors, including opportunity, economic stability, and zip code. But despite educational attainment, racism and structural inequities are more influential. Next slide. The causes of infant mortality across the state, this is for all children, congenital anomalies and prematurity account for just over half the deaths in the state. The leading causes do vary slightly by race and ethnic group, but congenital anomalies and prematurities are the leading causes of death for all groups, with the notable exception of American Indian infants. Obstetric causes, that red piece of the pie, is currently the leading cause. However, because the numbers are so small for American Indian infants, just a few cases can change the overall statistics. Next slide. And the next one, please. Governor Walz has renewed the commitment to improving the health of mothers and infants and reducing these disparities experienced by American Indians, African Americans, and other communities through the Children's Cabinet. Next slide. So when thinking about maternal health, the Minnesota Perinatal Quality Collaborative, and I'll explain a little bit more about what that is in just a moment, is a key component of our work. We also have a new grant that's promoting a promising model that will embed preconception counseling or interconception care into well child visits to help prevent birth defects and improve health for future pregnancies. Next slide. In 2018, Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Perinatal Organization co-founded the Minnesota Perinatal Quality Collaborative, the PQCs as they're called, are a network of clinical teams, public health professionals, stakeholders and partners, including patients and families that work together to improve pregnancy and infant outcomes. The members identify healthcare processes that need improvement within the state and then use best available methods to effect quick change. We have three initiatives happening right now in the state: preterm birth prevention, hypertension, and opioid. These three efforts all focus on areas that will improve both maternal and infant outcomes. I'd also like to highlight that the PQC contributed significantly to disseminating best clinical care practices for COVID-positive pregnant and postpartum people during the very early days of the pandemic. Next slide. More on the infant health slide. Infant health side, Minnesota Department of Health works across the state to promote safe sleep practices, including providing content in a number of languages. We also have a grant with the Star Legacy Foundation offering bereavement support following an infant death or stillbirth to families here in Minnesota. And I also can't say enough about our family home visiting program, and I understand that you heard more in detail about that program a few weeks ago. Next slide. And just a quick note on our funding. We use both federal funds from the Title V block grant and specific competitive grants, like the Perinatal Quality Collaborative is funded with a grant from CDC, along with state funds to support these programs. The federal funding has not kept pace with the needs for infant and maternal health, especially the hard work of partnering with communities to reduce these disparities experienced by Black and American Indian families here in Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me to present today, and I look forward to your questions.
Ms. Fogg, thank you. I know that was both for you and for members a really quick spin through that, through some just really, really important information. I want to make sure we at least folks had an orientation to these issues. And I should probably note for members that especially because of the way the Department of Health accounts are structured, some of these programs our committee will have a somewhat more direct connection to, many won't have as direct a connection to. But it, given what we've learned about kind of the impact on everything involving young kids, it seemed really important for us to be aware of these. And I guess what's jumping out to me especially are those just stunning and awful numbers showing the disparity in infant mortality for moms of different races and for Black and American Indian parents especially. I'm just looking to see, Representative Wazlik, I see that you have a question, so we'll call on a question or comment. So Representative Wazlik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if, Ms. Fogg, if you could talk a little bit about reasons for those disparities that we saw. I think it's, you know, we hear anecdotes from folks about how the differences in medical care that they receive based on who they are and what they look like. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about reasons for those disparities.
Ms. Fogg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Yes, I think that what you're hearing is correct. There is a difference in experience of care that families experience. There are, of course, access barriers to access and barriers to good quality of care, but we also hear from families the same thing. And I think the point about education really drives home the point that there's a larger system of inequities that those families face.
Representative Wasilewicz, follow up.
Nope, that's all. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Fogg, for your presentation. I'm wondering if you could, are you able to go back to one of the slides? It was the barriers to prenatal care in Minnesota. If you can't, I think I have it written down here, but I'd like to
pull it up if we can, have Ms. Fogg, if you can, just so folks can see it as well. I don't know if Ms. Fogg, if that's going to be doable. And then please, yeah, Representative Morrison, you can point us to, or we'll get.
Okay. Please continue. I thought that was, there we go. Very compelling that the biggest barrier to getting early prenatal care seems to be didn't know that I was pregnant. And I think that speaks to the need for comprehensive sex education in our schools so that people understand what's happening with their bodies and are able to get the care they need as soon as possible in their pregnancy. That's an important barrier that we have to get past. And then I was also interested in your comment about the importance of interconception care, so care between pregnancies. And I think that also speaks to the need for making sure that new moms have access to healthcare in between the pregnancies. So for example, extending MA to 12 months postpartum so that they can get the regular care that benefits the mom when we're looking at our disparities in maternal mortality in part. It also gets to preparing for future pregnancies. Getting the mental health care, hugely important. So I just wanted to comment on those two points. Thanks again for your presentation, very informative.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. And I couldn't agree more with those points. Representative, and Ms. Fogg, if you have any comments on any of these, please step on in. But Representative Katiza Witum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Fogg, for your presentation today. So you spoke about COVID right at the beginning of your presentation, and so I'm actually about 6 months postpartum, actually, and I received much of my care throughout the pandemic, and some of it was telehealth. Obviously, this is all anecdotal, but I'm curious what sort of data we might already have been gathering or data that will be gathered for, you know, women who transportation is an issue. So, I mean, often like throughout the pandemic, public transportation has been restricted. So if they couldn't get to those doctor's appointments, if they were able to access the telehealth appointments, and what sort of impact that may have kind of going forward. I'm just curious if you have anything to share on that.
Ms.
Yet,
Fogg.
Or if it will be coming.
Oh,
thank you.
Ms. Fogg.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and committee members. First, congratulations. I think you had a very unique experience. This information that we're looking at right now about barriers to prenatal care is from our Minnesota Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System, or PRAMS. And it has a lag. So I think that we'll be interested to look at that 2020 data when it becomes available. It'll be a while, but I do think that we have some quicker turnaround information that we may be able to get from other programs. I do agree with you that I think we're going to see some shifts, and I think and how care was received this year. And I think actually more interestingly, we have a lot to learn about what benefits and what issues did this create. What we've heard from some programs is that it created an opportunity for families to access care that they maybe otherwise would not have accessed. But we also know that this may have shut out people or in some way not allowed them to have a rich experience in terms of relationship building in some cases as well. So no data yet, but I do think what we're hearing things and I think we'll have better data soon.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Katisa Batun.
Thank you so much for kind of detailing that a little bit. One of the examples that we had heard, I think, from a presenter maybe last week about the in-person group prenatal care that is sometimes available and specifically helpful to women who maybe are in their first pregnancy or kind of in a range of socioeconomic statuses so that they can really build those relationships. And I think, I mean, I was scheduled to participate in one of those groups and then we had two meetings and then obviously everything went into a hiatus. So I think that really could be impactful. And while women who are, who have older children and, you know, aren't necessarily on their first pregnancy have kind of a system already built up around them, I think that could really have had a difficult impact for those who are first time mothers and don't necessarily have the structure around them to help them. And then given the exacerbation of COVID with social distancing and not being able to socialize with people outside of your home, I'm hopeful that, you know, didn't have a far-reaching negative impact, but I'll be awaiting those statistics as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Katisa Batun. Representative Pryor, you're up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Vlog, if you could go to the slide that kind of had some counties, larger counties on the slide, and then the one that was about, it had Ramsey and Hennepin, and then it had rural and urban and metro, and it was, okay.
Yep, keep going, Lisa. That one, yep. With just the blue bars, one before that. Yep, that one.
So I'm wondering when I look at that or some understandings that I have is, for instance, Ramsey County has a lot of our new immigrant population. And so you have language barriers, you have cultural barriers, and many, many more barriers in this population than in other populations, more stable populations. And so, if we're kind of looking at overall, but it's also a young population of people who are more likely to be at childbearing age. So is there any understanding now too of kind of like it's disaggregating this data? And, you know, it's not just Black women, but if you're a new immigrant Black woman, how your experience compares to the experience of people, you know, families that have been in Minnesota for generations.
Ms. Fogg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for raising this this point, Representative Pryor. Actually, the reverse is almost true. So mm-hmm. What we are finding in the statistics is that U.S. infants born to U.S. born African American mothers. So folks who were born here in the United States have an infant mortality rate that's double those born to infants with mothers who are born not in the United States. Mm-hmm. So there's actually a protective effect that we're seeing for immigrants, for newer immigrants here in Minnesota. We're closely monitoring that because the data beyond Minnesota suggests that this protective effect of being born outside of the United States only lasts for 2 to 3 generations, and then that protective effect fades. The hypothesis there is that systemic racism and the difference that's the experience and ingrained in our society, and that is what's been published in the literature explaining that difference that we're seeing. I also think that while there's there's a small, this is a small set of data that we're looking at, but we're carefully monitoring as in as much detail as possible about different different groups here, different immigrant groups here in Minnesota, to make sure that we're paying attention to the cultural factors that may be present and responding in a way that's appropriate, trying to reach those communities with the, you know, the best possible services available.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Ms. Hogg, for another stark call to reality of where we stand in Minnesota, you know, in terms of what the effects are of systemic racism. So it's profoundly tragic and disturbing, and just a good reminder of where we are right now, and a motivation to do better, to change. Thank you.
Could we go back one slide? Just as I'm going to ask a clarifying question, but it feels like it's worth having this in front of us. Ms. Fogg, so am I right in thinking too that infant mortality rates would be correlated with other health concerns for the infant and other concerns as well? I mean, more obviously, the death of an infant is so tragic and is one extreme version of things. But am I right in thinking that there's a similar racial correlation when it comes to, you know, other health issues and other things as well?
Mr. Chair, thanks for that question. I'm not sure that I can fully answer that question. I'm not sure that I can fully answer that question. I think what we're looking at here is obviously the worst case scenario, but measuring poor outcomes for infants, you know, other poor non-life-threatening outcomes for infants is something that I'd like to provide better data on.
And Ms. Fogg, I'd be interested in that if you can. Part of the reason I'm thinking about this is connecting with the presentation that we just had from Dr. Sojourner, and just thinking that, as you say, the impact of racism, it seems to be the drive behind this, especially with what you described about non-U.S. born or children born to immigrants, and then recognizing that with this situation of the death of an infant, but then other health situations as well, and Dr. Sojourner and I talking about how you set the cycle, it's just incredible the impact of racism in our society. And I just really appreciate you providing this information. And I hope that all of us on this committee keep this slide in particular in our minds, that's linked to so much in our society. So I see Representative Damuth's hand is up. So Representative Damuth, please.
Ms. Fogg, thank you for your presentation. And something that is new to me that you've just shared is that protective effect of the immigrant moms or the infants born to the immigrant moms. Can you tell me how that Minnesota data that you've shared, how that is compared to other states? Do you have that information?
Mr. Chair and Representative, are you asking in particular around the protective effect or the difference between U.S.-born and foreign-born infants?
Clarifying, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fogg, it would be the immigrants born, the protective effect for the Minnesota-born.
Yes. In Mr. Chair, in response to that question, the same effect that we're seeing, that protective effect for infants born to women who are not born in the United States, is something that we're seeing beyond Minnesota as well.
And then one more follow-up, Mr. Chair. I think you're muted, but I'm reading your lips, if that's okay.
Oh, I have been muted this whole time, Representative Damuth.
That's okay.
No wonder you weren't hearing me. That's so funny. That's okay. Yes, Representative Damuth, please.
Ms. Fogg, I appreciate that. As you get that additional information as how it compares across other states too, would you be able to share that as your work continues on with this?
Ms. Fogg.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to share that information, and there is a growing body of published literature on this same issue, because it is an important phenomenon, especially in communities like ours, where we have a large and growing number of immigrants who are part of our community as well.
Thank you, Ms. Fogg. Please do send that to us. And so, Representative Damuth, any follow-up from you?
Just one more follow-up. Thank you, Ms. Foss. Ms. Fogg, you talked about the third or fourth generation. If you could also include information as it compares to other states, is that unique to Minnesota, or is that what you're seeing across the nation also?
Please, Ms. Fogg, you can do that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes, we do have information. I believe most of the studies are about this protective effect are primarily either national or several states in comparison, and it's what we are seeing in the data here in Minnesota, but that protective effect is certainly a component we can share with you.
Please do send that our way, Ms. Fogg. That's really helpful to have. For us to understand this. We have one more presentation and some tight timing here. So I want to thank you so much, Ms. Fogg. And if I can ask Ms. Franken to go, I'm sorry that we're a little bit squeezed here, but that was really powerful, both two powerful presentations, and you can wrap us up here. So Ms. Franken, if you can identify yourself and please proceed with your presentation about WIC.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. My name is Kate Franken. I'm the state WIC director at Minnesota Department of Health, also in the Child and Family Health Division. Let me share my slides here. Okay. Was invited here to provide an overview about the WIC program in Minnesota. And so we'll go through some slides to do that. So the WIC program in general is a public health nutrition and breastfeeding program. It's designed to help eligible pregnant women, new mothers, babies, and young children eat well, learn about nutrition, and stay healthy. The program provides nutrition education and counseling, nutritious foods, and referrals to other health and social services in the community. WIC eligibility is really based in three areas, and those include income, category, and nutrition risk. Income eligibility is 185% federal poverty guidelines or adjunctive eligibility, and I'll share a bit more about that in the next slide. For category, that means a pregnant, breastfeeding, or postpartum woman, an infant defined up to 1 year of age, and children up to their fifth birthday. And then nutrition risk. And a nutrition risk is determined through a health and nutrition assessment as a part of the application certification process with WIC. So I mentioned WIC adjunctive eligibility. And what that means is that individuals or families that are enrolled in one of the following programs there, Medicaid, SNAP, MFIP, you can see the rest of them, are automatically income eligible for WIC. And that really makes a difference for both a family, I think, and local WIC staff in determining eligibility. The family doesn't have to show proof of income again. The local certifier just needs to verify current enrollment in that program. And I would say we in Minnesota and many states, we a large proportion of our caseload is eligible through adjunctive eligibility. The largest is through Medicaid. A little bit about WIC program funding. So we are funded by a federal grant from the United States Department of Agriculture, Food and Nutrition Service. And annually, we receive funding from USDA in kind of two pots of money. The first, approximately $30 million annually for nutrition services and administration. And that really covers program costs at both the state and local level. And then our second sort of pot of money is approximately $57 million annually, and that covers the costs of WIC food benefits. We also have, as we're required to by USDA regulations, a contract with an infant formula company where we receive a rebate on every infant formula redeemed and purchased with WIC funds. And we receive approximately $26 million. And those funds are used to really extend our ability to cover WIC food costs. They're only used to cover WIC food costs. Of our NSA, what we call NSA funding, our administrative funding, 75% of that goes to our local WIC grantees that provide services at the local level. And that's through a per participant funding formula. And so in Minnesota, the program is really set up. We have statewide reach. It's available in all 87 counties and 7 Ojibwe tribes in the northern part of the state. For managing the program, we have the state sort of broken up into 8 different regions. And there's a regional WIC nutritionist that supports those agencies. We currently have 54 grantees. That represents 45 community health boards, many of them multi-county. 7 tribes, as I mentioned, and 2 community action partnerships. And Minnesota has long enjoyed a high coverage rate for the WIC program. What that means really is USDA does reports on the share of people eligible for WIC who receive benefits. And it varies substantially across states. In Minnesota, you can see we are, for 2017, which is the most recently published report, Minnesota ranks 3rd in the nation for serving eligible individuals. So we are at a coverage rate of 58.8. The overall WIC coverage rate generally increased between 2005 and 2011. But since 2011, the overall coverage rate has been declining, and we've seen that true in Minnesota as well. However, we have continued to have a high level of a rate of coverage compared with other states. On an average monthly basis for the year 2020, WIC served 100,000, just over 100,000 women, infants, and children per month in 2020. And you can see that breakdown. Our largest proportion of participants includes children, and then women and infants at nearly equal proportions. And in 2019, Minnesota served 40% of all infants born in our state. WIC works, and we know that WIC is a time-tested, effective program. WIC participation improves health outcomes, it reduces low birth weight, increases key intake of nutrients, contributes to a healthy weight among preschool children, increases breastfeeding initiation. Prenatal and early WIC participation is associated with cognitive and academic benefits. And WIC participation saves money. Medicaid participants on WIC average 29% lower Medicaid costs for infant hospitalization. And the return on investment is good for the program. So we know it's a time-tested, effective program. One of the benefits, of course, received by WIC to WIC participants is the WIC supplemental foods. And this slide just shows a sample of what some of those foods are. And I think sometimes people don't have a current maybe or full understanding of what that might look like. And of course, food packages are prescribed for each individual that's participating in WIC, and they vary by category. So for instance, a pregnant woman will have a slightly different food package from, of course, an infant and a child. So on average, the value of the monthly food package for a child in 2020 was $76 a month. And you can see kind of what that includes there in terms of the types of foods and the amounts of foods. And I think that's one thing that's unique with WIC for certain is that the foods that are offered as supplemental in WIC are very systematically designed to provide those nutrients that are most important during those growth and development times and are often lacking in diets.
I'm afraid I'm going to have you wrap up in just about 2 minutes. Sorry. Okay. To do that to you. Yeah,
that's okay. Let me just speed through a few here. Nutrition education is a hallmark of WIC services. And really is one of the pieces that's unique from other programs. Breastfeeding support and education is critical as well. And WIC provides a larger amount of food package to a breastfeeding woman for that reason. Many agencies throughout the state, though not all, provide services from a peer breastfeeding counselor. And that's, they're recruited from the communities that they live in, often speak the same language, and that has proven to be a very effective program in our state and nationally. This just shows kind of we support and have agreements with WIC authorized stores throughout the state of different sizes. And that's our food delivery model essentially is retail based. Annually, we look at the value, the annual dollars spent in local grocery stores around the state by congressional district. This is data that we make available on our website and is included in the slides. In 2019, we were able to fully move the state from paper benefits to eWIC, and that was a huge transition we're very proud of. And so in that way, households actually are issued a card and all of their benefits are combined on that card. There's a link in this slide if you're interested in what that looks like for families to redeem their benefits. We have a mobile app that is available to participants to help support them in selecting foods, reminders about appointments, et cetera. And I'll just briefly mention, of course, during the pandemic, we've had quickly changed delivery of services, moving to remote services, really in all clinics, about 200 clinics statewide in March when the pandemic really became an issue. And so those services are, rather than in person, they're provided by phone or telehealth with online and text options kind of to add. That also means we're not getting regular measurements and hemoglobin from our families as well, but that's, of course, to maintain that safe environment for our families and staff. And that's it.
Ms. Franken, thank you so much, both for your work and for your speed through that. I should note for members that our recently departed committee administrator, Alyssa Fritz, had previously worked with the WIC program as a huge champion for it. And I know, I'm not sure if she's watching, but I'm so glad that we've at least gotten this orientation. We've got just 2 minutes for a question here, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did have two questions. It seems like I heard in a different presentation that we actually in Minnesota, we do pretty well on breastfeeding and the number of mothers. Okay, so you can confirm that, which I think
yes.
is really, really important. And then the second is, are there parts of, you said that now there was more of the telehealth or the teleconferencing with families, and that there are certain things that you're not getting their physical measurements, but did that change participation at all? Was there any benefits from not having families have to come in to do certain things?
Ms. Franken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so we know that with the move to remote services, we've seen higher show rates, as we call them. People keep their appointments more because, of course, they don't have to travel to the clinic. They don't have to haul their kids, all that sort of stuff. So we are having better interactions that way. We have also seen an increase in participation since the pandemic began. And the biggest increase we saw really from March to April, but we continue to see an increase most recently in December. That's the last data that we have access to.
Ms. Pryor, looks like no follow-up there. I may just ask, just real briefly, it sounded like only about 50% of eligible families are participating. And I just wonder if you could just say, and again, we've got maybe 60 seconds here, but what are the main factors that are causing that to be? It seems, I know Minnesota is doing better than the rest of the country, but why overall are those numbers only at half?
Well, and it's sort of the million-dollar question in many ways, but I think the WIC program offers, I always think, broad benefits, not just supplemental foods, but nutrition education and counseling, breastfeeding support, referrals, and that involves more of a time commitment in comparison to other programs. So I think for some families, WIC has been a little more challenging to stay active with, and we are working to bring those barriers down to offer more choice in how you can follow up with WIC. And making the process more streamlined for them. So I think that's part of it. The birth rate is the lowest it's been, in 30 some years as well. And so we do have fewer babies, but you're right that the coverage rate overall nationally has been lowered.
Okay, thank you. Thanks so much for that, answering that, and again, for the presentation and for your just incredibly important work. I don't see other hands raised from members. Hopefully, members, this has given you a good orientation over the last couple of weeks to some of the programs that we have to support healthy development for kids, which, of course, ties into everything else that we're working on. With that, members, next week we're going to pivot more firmly into talking about early care and learning issues. On Tuesday, we're going to be learning about the workforce and kind of economics of childcare. And on Thursday, hearing from our Department of Human Services, talking about a number of aspects, including childcare assistance and other issues, and continue from there. So with that, we are adjourned. Thank you so much to members and members of the public. Take care, and we'll see.